Welcome to episode 381 of the Entertainment 2.0 podcast, brought to you by thedigitalmediazone.com. I'm your host and producer, Josh Pollard.
And I'm Richard Gunther, and this is the show where we talk about Microsoft Entertainment Technology, including audio, video, gaming, and more across all Windows platforms.
And this week, we'd like to welcome back good friend of the show, Rob H. The H stands for, honestly, he's an HDR expert.
Well, thank you very much for having me back. I'm very excited to be back while Richard is also here. We haven't had a chance to speak face-to-face virtually over Skype before, so that's exciting for me. But I never refer to myself as an expert in anything, but you know, if any of the info I hand out there is helpful and useful, then that makes me very happy. So I will accept that.
All right. Well, we've got Rob back this week. I can't remember which episode you were on last time, but you gave us quite a primer on what the heck HDR is and why it's the bigger deal when it comes to the latest generation of TVs. And in the meantime, we've had an Xbox One S launch that has all of that HDR, well, most of that HDR goodness. And we wanted to bring you on to discuss those finer points and what's going on with 4K and HDR right now. And I couldn't think of a better person to teach me and the rest of our listeners what the heck is going on there.
Well, thanks very much. And that might be a little bit of a misdirection, because as much as we will be talking about 4K and HDR on the show today, I actually focus on audio quite a bit more. and that is where the real interesting meat and potatoes has come to light in terms of the Xbox One S, as well as a few other areas of things like Plex and that I'm sure we'll get into tonight. So that's that might be where I end up focusing more, even if you try to keep dragging me back to HDR land.
So, Rob, in case people don't know who you are,
yes,
your maybe your internet claim to fame is that you're also a podcaster. For anyone who doesn't know, you have your own podcast that you do with another gentleman named Tom Andrey called AV Rant Podcast. It's an awesome show. I'll let you describe it, but I want to personally, publicly here on the show, congratulate you guys, because you guys just hit a huge milestone. You just hit 500 episodes of your podcast, and that's pretty stinking awesome.
That is correct, and it was an extra long, as if our podcast wasn't long enough already. For folks who aren't aware, AV Rant is a question and answer show. We say it's your home theater and AV questions answered, and we do. We get lots of questions every week. We normally run about 2 hours and typically have three or four questions that we don't even have time to get to and end up rolling over into the next week. But episode 500, we did in two parts. It ended up being about 3 hours and 20 minutes long if you put both of the halves together. So it was pretty wild. But yeah, it was an interesting milestone. And to celebrate that milestone, we actually began our first giveaway. Even though we've done 500 episodes, I haven't been there for all of them. Tom has been there for almost all of them. I joined a few years into the show. But yeah, we joined up with SVS, famous maker of speakers and subwoofers that sell primarily online, but they're in retail as well. And we recommend their products. We don't accept sponsorship or ads or anything from any manufacturers or brands or anything like that. Your products better be good. And if somebody comes along and does something better than you, then we'll start recommending them. But for right now, we definitely like SVS's products. That's been a good relationship. We've talked with their president and CEO a couple of times on the show. And so he agreed. They're doing a giveaway. So I just want to let people know, come to avrant.com. Right at the top of the page, it'll be stuck there until the end of September. All you have to do is enter your email address and you'll be entered to possibly win two PB1000 subwoofers. Because if you've ever listened to anything AV Rant has ever said, you know we were all about more than one subwoofer, at least two. So it would be insane for us to have a giveaway that was only one sub. And thankfully, SVS agreed. So you can win two PB1000s, or if you want a 5.1 speaker package, you can opt for their 5.1 Satellite Prime speaker package instead. So all you have to do, enter your email address. Unfortunately, it's only open to residents of the US and Canada. So I apologize to European and Asian listeners and you know, anyone Australian, everywhere around the world that isn't US and Canada. But those are the rules. So avrant.com, come check it out. And yeah, thanks so much for letting me mention that at the top of the show. I want people to have a chance to win those prizes.
Yeah, I almost said no to letting you mention it, because yeah, I've entered and I don't want other people to win. That just decreases my chances. But
No, that's great. And I hope you do win, although I hope everyone wins and they can't, because there's really only one prize being
given. All right. Well, you mentioned 2.5 hours. Hopefully this will not be a 2.5 hour long episode. And to aid in that, we don't have any feedback this week, but if people want to leave us feedback, they can do so by contacting us at entertainment20@thedigitalmediazone.com. So let's dive right into our news topics. Video starts us off, and you have some news from Mark Terberg.
I do. We're going to reach all the way back into our Windows Media Center roots here for a moment. And I think most of our Windows Media Center fans will know that one of our all-time favorite Windows Media Center plugins is a little one called Recorded TV HD. That is a great plugin for giving you an alternative view of your recorded TV library, and gives you different ways to slice and dice it up by user and lots of other different ways of handling that. He also developed an app called My Memories, which is an alternative Windows Media Center screensaver app that's like the photo slideshow, but does even more than what the built-in Windows Media Center slideshow screensaver does. Both of those products have always had a cost to them. Well, the big announcement here is they're now free. Mark messaged us this week and said he's made them completely free. You just need to go to the website and download them. In the case of Recorded TV HD, he provides you a product key to put in to the registration screen when that is necessary. And that's it. That's awesome. That is really awesome news.
That's the good news.
Exactly. The kind of bad news is one of the reasons he's making it free is that he doesn't plan to be actively supporting it anymore. I don't believe he's had any major releases for quite a long while. So he's going to be sunsetting it, but he doesn't want it to go away just because he isn't really able to support it anymore. He still wants people to be able to use it. So you can get it for free. You can't directly ask for support from him, but they have forums on the website where other users are using it. He himself may even pop into those forums occasionally, I would imagine, but he won't directly be supporting the apps any longer. He also, unfortunately, does not plan to open source them. You know, that's kind of a bummer, but at the same time, it's a Media Center plugin, and how much value is there still in the source code to a Windows Media Center plugin?
I get it. I understand that people might want it open source. I can understand that he might not want to make it open source, but it's really awesome that he's making it available to people. So that's great. I use this every single night, and luckily it is still very reliable for me. So hopefully it won't need any updates as long as Media Center continues to run on Windows 7 and Windows 8.
And Windows Media Center itself has managed to continue on without supported updates. So assuming there won't be any changes to it, which I think is a pretty safe assumption, having no changes to Recorded TV HD shouldn't break anything, one would imagine. So unless it's an underlying OS update that ends up breaking something for everybody.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, another plugin that we like for Media Center is My Movies. And we got word from the developer, Brian Binnerup, that they needed to put out a quick patch to address a service issue that they experienced last week. And so if you're using My Movies, be sure to go in and update it to 5.2.2 build 2. Now, depending on your system, you may get notified that this update's available, and it may allow you to download it and install in place. I ended up having to go out and actually download and install it manually. So check that out. If you're still using My Movies on Windows or Windows servers, you need to make sure that you're getting the latest build, and that helps address a problem that they were having on their servers.
All right. Well, thank you for that update. Another huge news story this week. Plex, the app that it seems like we can't stop talking about on this show, has released a new version of their media server, and this time they've added support for DVR functionality. That means that if you have an HD home run tuner, and it doesn't really matter which one. It could be an over-the-air tuner, it could be a cable card tuner, doesn't matter. The Plex DVR will plug right into that. You just need to update your Plex Media Server app on your Windows PC. It does require you to have a Plex Pass subscription, as many of the new features do require while they're in somewhat of a beta period. You can then just go to the forums, download the new version, and set it up. It'll look for your HD home run tuner. You set it up, you tell it which channels you want in your guide. It'll also scan them for you if you'd like. And then you get DVR functionality. But that's not really nuanced enough to really explain what this does, because it does some of the things you'd expect, but not all of them just yet. So, for example, it is a digital video recorder in the purest definition, purest sense of that possible definition. It records TV. It does not allow you to watch live TV or even time shift TV. If you know, if you want to start a show 15 minutes late, you can't. You have to wait until Plex DVR has finished recording the episode before it'll even show up in your library. But once it does, then that recorded TV show is available on all of your Plex clients. That's also an important thing to note. While the recorded shows are available on all of your clients, the ability to manage the DVR, so to see what you could record or to see what you've set to record, all of that functionality is only accessible through the web interface. Now, I'm sure that's going to change. But right now, it means you've got to open a web browser if you want to be scheduling some of your TV shows to record.
I'm not convinced that's a bad thing. I like the way that works, actually. I think the only thing that I'd like to see them add is put it on tablet apps. I don't think it's necessary to put it on the 10-foot interface. In fact, I think if anything, it would confuse most people who know how to use a DVR, because it is so different from how most people are used to surfing content through a traditional guide.
Yeah, so it has a guide, and it has guide data using Gracenote.
I don't know that I would call what it has a guide, at least not as people are used to seeing it.
Yeah, it's not a traditional grid guide like you're used to seeing in Windows Media Center or on a TiVo or probably even your cable box DVR if you have one. Instead, if you're familiar with how the HD Home Run DVR works, it's a lot more similar to that, wherein you... to see what's on right now or pretty much at any time in the future, you get a poster view like you're used to seeing in Plex, but maybe not so used to seeing in a DVR. It's got filters so that you can filter down to like sports programs that are on right now and or upcoming or movies and things like that. But yeah, you're not just going to get a list of channels and what's on those channels right at that moment. It's a poster view of the shows that are on right now.
It should also maybe be mentioned that you did say right at the top, this came via an update to Plex Media Server, but it is not compatible with the NVIDIA Shield TV version of the Plex Media Server, not yet. And so obviously we're expecting an update for that, but currently it's Windows and Mac PCs only as far as the media server goes. And then when it comes to the cable card support, it does work with cable card tuners, but it doesn't work with any copy protected content.
How do you know? You don't have a cable card in Canada.
We certainly don't. We definitely don't, but I was reading through the news and taking their word for it. So
no, you're absolutely
correct. I'm assuming Plex wouldn't lie about that themselves, because it's not necessarily something you trumpet right. As saying, yes, we work with cable cards, but not anything that's copy protected.
Right, exactly. If you have a cable card tuner, which is what I'm using with it, the HD Home Run tuner, when software like this ask for a list of channels, the HD Home Run indicates which channels are copy protected. And so in the case of Plex, it just doesn't even show the DRM channels in the quote unquote guide. So yeah, that's a really important thing to point out. If you've got a lot of copy protected channels, this probably still isn't the thing for you. But if you're going OTA or maybe you're on Verizon Fios, then maybe copy protection isn't as big of an issue for you.
Yeah, it certainly isn't a Windows Media Center replacement yet for DVR functionality. There's certainly a lot of caveats still going on as far as the Plex DVR goes. But I mean, the nice thing is, obviously, Plex is very good at continuing to develop their software. This is not the last iteration of it. And once it eventually comes out of beta and doesn't require a Plex Pass anymore, I expect it will be quite a bit more capable than where it's beginning its life right now. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they can add to it. But that whole copy protected thing seems to be a stumbling block for almost everybody. So
right. Yep.
Now, one thing that I want to notice here or want to note here is that when I went to set up some recordings, I had one recording, and everybody knows I watch Big Brother, so I went to record a series recording for Big Brother, and it didn't show up. And what I was eventually able to figure out is that when I had it set to record HD only, it did not find... No, sorry, new and repeat episodes. Sorry, when I had it set to record new episodes only, it did not find any of the episodes. But when I cleared that option and allowed it to record any episodes, then it found the new episodes that are going to air. So I don't know if that's a glitch with the data or if that's a glitch with the system, but check when you set up recordings if you're giving this a try and make sure that it actually shows the recordings that you're expecting to see there.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It does sound, that does sound like a guy data issue. I've set up a few recordings. I did have at least one series recording that is already successfully recorded, and quite a few one-off recordings that have all successfully recorded. So I haven't had any issues yet. It's all been working pretty smoothly. But as we've all noted here, there are some things that we'd like to see changed and some features added. But like Rob pointed out, Plex is known to be constantly updating their software. So hopefully we'll see a lot of those improvements soon. And again, as Rob pointed out, hopefully be bringing this to the NVIDIA Shield soon, because I've been in the process of moving to making the Shield be my primary and hopefully only Plex server. And all of a sudden I couldn't do that. That kind of stopped me in my tracks of that transition. So that's unfortunate. Let's move on to the next story. Sticking with all of these different media management apps, another really popular one out there is called Embee. For our longtime Windows Media Center users out there, you might remember it as Media Browser. It a few years ago changed its name to Embee. E-M-B-U-I. This is an app that's also on pretty much everything, including on Windows as a universal Windows platform app. And you can probably tell where this is going. It's a UWP. Well, guess what? They released it for the Xbox One. So if you're an Embee user, now you can grab the Embee client, run it on your Xbox One. And again, it's an app that's similar to Plex. It gives you all of your media library stuff, but it's also got a lot of extra plugins built into it. It also has support for TV, including live TV. I don't know the extent of their TV tuner list. I know that the HD Home Run tuners are supported, but I don't know what else is in that list. But I'm also pretty certain that it's going to have the same sort of limitations when it comes to copy protected content. So if you're looking for cable card content, that's probably not going to work if your stuff is copy protected. But again, I'm not a big Embee user, so I haven't gotten a chance to actually check this out, especially on the Xbox One, but it's out there. If you are, it's now out there and available.
Yeah. From the list that I could find online, their Embee's list of supported tuners seems to be pretty comprehensive. We should maybe go back and clarify that the Plex DVR currently only supports HD Home Run tuners.
Right.
So that was probably mentioned, but might have been skipped over. So yeah, so Embee seems to have wider support, and they do have the live TV support. This is one of those programs that I have known about for a long time and just never had the time to dig into. And a lot of it looks very promising. So one of these days I'll find time, maybe, I don't know, when I'm 80, I don't.
Right. I mean, there's so many apps like this that you kind of find one that you really like and you find that it really works for you.
Or just functions well enough, you know?
Right. Like... right. And I think you, like me, have kind of latched on to Plex as of late. So
a little bit, yeah.
It's hard to make that jump because there is a lot of setup that goes into trying out these different things. So
yeah, and you were mentioning how MB is on a lot of platforms, but not quite the ubiquity of Plex. I mean, Plex you will find built right into smart TVs, and you'll find it on every NAS server, and you know all sorts of platforms. So Plex is still the wider, more easily supported, often easier found app in whatever app store and that. So that gives them a little bit of an advantage there. But yeah, MB is certainly something I want to check out. You know what? Everything is sort of owed to XBMC, though, isn't it? Way back when. All of these are kind of like, you know, distant forks of XBMC when you come right down to it.
Right. All right. So that does it for most of our actual video news. So this seems like a really great place to start talking about HDR and 4K. And where the heck are we now, Rob?
Yeah, well, we're at an interesting place. What has basically happened is we've seen another ratification by the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, and they've now ratified something called BT2100. So we've heard of BT709, right? That was what we used for HD broadcast. We've heard about BT2020, which is what was going to be used for ultra high definition broadcast. But now they've cleared this new one, BT2100. And you can very much think of BT2100 as an extension, an expansion of BT2020, because it takes everything that was in BT2020, including that large color space that maybe BT2020 is most well known for, but as well as the high frame rate support, of course, the Ultra HD and even 8K resolution support. All of those things continue on. But what BT2100 really does is define the high dynamic range standards that are going to be used. And again, when we're talking ITU BT20 whatever standards, we're talking about broadcast primarily. So what they've said is if you are a broadcaster, you can choose to use either HDR that is based on PQ, which is the perceptual quantizer, and that is the electro-optical transfer function that Dolby developed.
Oh my gosh.
Which was ratified as BT2084.
Yeah, what does any of that mean? Come on.
Yeah, so really, really what it comes down to is we've defined this new, in the old standard dynamic range, we had everything from 0 to 100 nits, and we were working with 8-bit language, so we had 256 steps to get you from 0 to 100. Well, now high dynamic range can go up as high as 10,000 nits, so obviously we need to have more than 256 steps to do that. Now we're using 10-bit video, but that really only expands us to 1,024 steps. And it sounds like we went a lot greater going from 100 to 10,000 nits than just adding those extra 750 or so steps would seem to allow. So what we need is a non-linear function. We need some way of saying this value equates to this much light coming out of the display. And so the PQ, the perceptual quantizer that Dolby developed, is one way of defining that. Our eye is not linear at all. It takes exponentially more and more light for us to notice that something is brighter. So it doesn't make sense to define the levels from 0 to 10,000 nits linearly in digital values. It makes much more sense to put them on some kind of a curve. So that's what PQ is. It's a type of a curve, but everything is very clearly defined in PQ. This precise value out of the 1,024 values available equals exactly this many nits. That's how PQ works. It's a exact one-to-one correlation. There's no sort of fuzzing or wiggle room within it. And it works very well. That's what HDR10 is based on. That's what Dolby Vision is based on. But now the BBC and NHK in Japan have long been touting something else that they call HLG or hybrid log gamma. And the words hybrid log gamma are very fitting. You might recall that when we were talking with standard dynamic range, we used a curve called gamma. There was the gamma curve that you could set in your digital display, and that was meant to replicate the natural curve of phosphors that we used to find in CRT televisions, which was saying one of these values out of the 256 that we have, how much light should be coming out of the display in response to that? Well, phosphors naturally gave us a curve, and then digital displays had to mimic that curve with a curve that we called gamma. Well, if we just continue the gamma curve all the way up to 10,000 nits, we'd need at a minimum 16 bits just to have enough values to define all the light levels from 0 to 10,000. In fact, we'd probably need something closer to 18 or 20 bits. And that starts to eat up too much bandwidth. So since we know that the eye needs exponentially more and more light to even notice a difference, why don't we dog leg that curve up even higher, right? And that's what they've done. So from 0 to 100 nits, it's still using the old gamma curve. Then from 100 nits to 10,000 nits, it uses a logarithmic curve. So far fewer values necessary to go on a much steeper curve, and therefore we can go back to using 10 bits again. That's what hybrid log gamma is all about. So it doesn't require any metadata, hybrid log gamma. If you send it to a standard dynamic range display, the standard dynamic range display goes, all right, I'll show you everything from 0 to 100, and then I'll just clip everything above it because I don't understand what's going on there. But it works. You still get an image. And if you do have a hybrid log gamma display, it'll go, all right, I get what this curve means, and it'll display everything from 0 to 10,000 nits if that's what's in the signal. So the reason they like it for broadcast so much is it doesn't need any metadata. There's no chance of any metadata getting lost anywhere in the signal chain. Nobody has to write metadata onto it in order for it to work. It's just straight from the television through the production chain, as long as it's 10-bit, out through the broadcaster, and any display that is, you know, capable of accepting a 10-bit signal can show it without having to go into a special mode or anything. So it's very useful for live broadcast. You can imagine this, sports news, that type of thing. It makes a lot of sense. What's most important out of all of this, going back to the whole BT2100, is that they defined a way to convert between PQ and HLG. So if you have a television right now that understands HDR10, you don't have to worry that HLG is going to render that TV obsolete. Something in there, and they're doing this right now with firmware updates in existing displays that you can buy right now today, can convert the HLG signal into HDR10, and your HDR10 display can show it. So that's great news. I'm super happy about that. It means that even though we have one more alphabet soup thing to add to HDR, it does not render what we already have obsolete. Thank goodness.
Now, for sure. Is it a given that a manufacturer is going to update an HDR TV, or is that up to the manufacturer?
That is up to the manufacturer. So it is not necessarily a given. And it is not clear at all whether North American broadcasters will choose to even use HLG. Many people who know more about HDR10 than I do and than most anybody else out there does, they're saying, really, you don't have to worry about the metadata getting lost, which was a concern, because it's added at the very end. And as the processing gets more and more powerful, that can start to become automated, because what the metadata at the end of the process is doing is saying, what is the brightest that this image ever gets? That's what we're concerned with. And if you're recording something live, you don't know that ahead of time. So you can't write the metadata ahead of time to say, well, I know that what we're shooting will get to 4,000 nits and no brighter. We don't know that, but at the end of it, you put that metadata in. Right now, that's having to be done manually, but of course, someone will figure out how to do it automatically. And once that happens, there's no reason you can't broadcast HDR10 instead and have it work absolutely fine. So HLG's big thing is that you can show it on an SDR display, and it'll understand that signal just fine. You don't need dual broadcasts, which HDR10 would end up sort of requiring. So we'll see what happens, but it looks very promising. So, and at least it's all been ratified.
But when are we actually expecting to see HDR broadcast?
Yeah, well, we are looking at ATSC 3.0. That is going to be the broadcast standard for Ultra HD, and they're working feverishly to nail down the final specs on audio, which very much looks like it's going to be Dolby's AC4 and all of these HDR sort of requirements to go along with that. So 2020 is the safe bet, which is still, you know, many years away. That is absolutely expected. The tests are ongoing now, but because the whole ATSC 3.0 system hasn't been nailed down just yet, and then there will be a substantial outlay of cost for the broadcasters, because we are talking about moving to 10-bit systems. That's not an insignificant thing. So honestly, the safe answer is 2020. Which is kind of where the whole BT2020 came from. That one isn't just a random number or just a sequential number. They kind of did demand that number. So hopefully we'll start to see the first rollouts of it maybe next year. Obviously we've seen some 4K broadcast already occurring, like during with the Olympics, but you can hardly call that a wide rollout, every broadcaster doing it type of situation. It's far from that. So we'll right. gradually see more and more of it. But the goal was to have it be sort of ubiquitous, the new standard by 2020.
Okay. All right. So you've added this this HLG acronym on for us. You know, we just had IFA. IFA is a huge IFA, big trade show in Berlin. Lots of computers and all sorts of other things announced there. Anything for TVs come out of there?
Yeah, well, really, it was mainly that HLG was everywhere. Everybody was showing HLG, being that they were in Europe, and it's BBC and NHK that are the strong proponents of HLG. It was all over the place. JVC, Sony, LG, they were all showing it on the displays that they were showing. LG in particular, it was their existing current E6 OLEDs. And all they did was slap a firmware update in there, and HLG was off to the races. So what we were saying, that you know, that there is this conversion and that it can be updated with firmware, it's proven. We've seen it in action. It's not just a promise that's being made. It was interesting seeing some of the projectors that were announced at IFA, because JVC announced there it's a £30,000. All right, so talking $45,000. It's hardly what we'd call a consumer level, but their first full fat 4K panels. Before, they were doing, you know, 1080p panels that they were wobbling. But this is now a full 4K panel with a laser light engine and 3000 lumens of brightness and full HDR support and everything. So, you know, previously the competitor to that was Sony's $60,000 model. So, you know, it's coming down a little bit, and we're starting to see, really see HDR, in home projectors, which is also nice. So that was sort of the news there as far as displays go.
Okay. So we've now got a third standard, it sounds like, between HDR10 and Dolby Vision, and now HLG, but we're seeing HLG across the board for the most part, so we don't have to worry too much about that. But we've had HDR10 all over the place in the news with the Xbox One and all of these other sources. How is HDR10 working out?
So I'm going to defer to the real expert on this stuff, which is Stacy Spears. He works at SpectraCal. You might know his name from the Spears and Munsell HD benchmark disc that a lot of people use to set up and to help calibrate their displays. He is the expert of experts when it comes to this stuff. Now, he appeared on Home Theater Geeks, which is another podcast that I'm sure almost all of your listeners are aware of and listen to. That's Scott Wilkinson, who runs the AVS Forum, who does that podcast. He interviewed Stacy Spears. And boy, oh boy, did some stuff come to light that I wasn't aware of. Now, I mentioned this whole thing about HDR10 using metadata, and that what you need to know is the maximum brightness that the movie or the broadcast or whatever it is, you need to know the maximum brightness that ever gets to. The whole idea is you put in a piece of data that says the brightest this movie ever gets is 3000 nits. The display goes, okay, I'm an OLED, I can only get to 540. But I know that the movie gets to 3000, so what I should do is what's called tone mapping. It's taking the maximum data that's in there, scaling it down inside the TV to the maximum capabilities of the television itself, and then, you know, shifting everything down within that. The whole idea is to retain all of the detail that's in the image. So the one they always use is pan, because pan is available in HDR10 and in Dolby Vision. It was mastered at 4,000 nits, and it's got this scene where there's the sun in the sky. And if it's shown properly in HDR, the sun is a nice round circle, and it's a very bright sun, a nice round circle. Then you see the detail in the sky. The sky is still blue. The clouds are still white. It's a pretty remarkable image. But when HDR is not handled correctly, it all just sort of mushes out into a vast whiteness, like you might see in standard dynamic range, or just taking a photo of the sky with your camera. So what has happened is that, basically, because the Ultra HD Alliance came along and said, hey, we're going to define sort of a new de facto standard. We're going to say 1,000 nits is what your TV should be able to do, and DCI-P3 color is what your TV should be able to do. Well, if you're an Ultra HD Alliance member, we're going to start mastering to those specs, and you're going to start building TVs to those specs, and we're going to start using mastering monitors that adhere to those specs. And they almost created, in a backdoor kind of way, a similar situation to what we had with standard dynamic range, where what was in the content, what you watched at home, and what was on the mastering monitor was all the same. But the whole idea with HDR was we can put in the signal a bunch of stuff that maybe your current display can't show you, but in the future, and you upgrade and you buy a more capable display, then maybe it will. So let's not constrict the signal. Let's put everything in the signal, And then let's just get the TVs to look at that metadata, say, I can't do that right now, and let's tone map everything down. Well, unfortunately, there are discs out there, and we're talking about Ultra HD Blu-rays, and right now all Ultra HD Blu-rays use HDR10 for their HDR data. Some of them, according to Stacey Spears, and he would know because he tests these discs and he looks at the data very carefully, they don't put any metadata in there at all, or the metadata must be there, but they zero out all the values, which they essentially nullify all of the values, which means the TV gets it and goes, I don't know how bright this gets. I guess it gets 10,000 nits. I guess it uses full Rec 2020 color. I don't know what's going on here. You didn't give me any values. And because of that, of course, it can't tone map anything. How could it? It doesn't know what to attempt to tone map. Outside of that, some of them are doing the tone mapping, and sometimes the metadata is there on the disc, but they're not tone mapping it correctly. A lot of them are just saying everything from 0 to 1,000 nits, I'm not touching it, even if I can't show it. Right? Maybe I can only get to 700 nits, but I still am not going to tone map something that was mastered to 1,000, because I don't know, I don't want to. It's too hard to write the algorithm to do it. I don't know what the reason is, but it's not happening. So the bottom line is, we get back to Dolby Vision, where Dolby gets their hands on the display and says, and Dolby goes in there and measures it, and Dolby writes the tone mapping algorithms. And if you're releasing Dolby Vision content, they have to certify all of it, and it all works. You can show Pan, which was mastered at 4,000 nits, on an OLED that only gets to 540, and the sun is still a bright round circle, and the sky is still blue, and the clouds are still white, instead of it all washing out. When you show on the exact same OLED display, the HDR10 version, and it's all washed out. So, it's
so Solus Sweet in the chat wants to know, are there any websites keeping track of which Ultra HD Blu-rays are doing this? And is this a problem primarily with the disc, how the discs are being mastered, or is it a problem with the TVs and how they're handling it?
Well, the honest answer is both. The scarier thing is when the discs don't have the metadata on them, or the metadata is nulled out. That is a studio decision. Somewhere in the mastering process of that disc, they said, don't worry about it. Like, you know, we mastered at 1,000 nits, so why put any metadata in there? If the display adhered to the Ultra HD Alliance specs, it shouldn't be a problem. But what if they didn't? You know, we're just going to leave all those people out in the cold, right? So that's the more disturbing one. On the side of the televisions maybe not doing the tone mapping correctly, that could be updated with firmware. So that is less disturbing. That's a more solvable problem. As for a website's keeping track of which discs are doing it right, which displays are doing it right, there really isn't anything I can point anyone to, because gathering that data is not an easy thing. Actually being able to access the metadata directly and analyze it to see what the values are, that's something SpectraCal can do. It's not something that your average reviewer out there is going to be able to do. So I'm not aware, maybe there is, but I'm not aware of any website doing that level of detail.
Okay, so let's move into the Xbox space. We've got these fancy, well, I don't, but some of our listeners have fancy new Xbox One S's, and they've got their fancy HDR 4K TVs. What can they expect? What does this all mean for them? And how well is it working out? And what problems are they going to run into?
Well, if you don't care too much about audio, it's pretty great. It's very simple if you're connecting the Xbox One S as a UHD Blu-ray player directly to your 4K HDR supporting television. If you're doing that, everything's fine. What you will notice is that the other Ultra HD Blu-ray players that are out there from Samsung and Panasonic and Philips now, they all have two HDMI outputs. And the reason they did that is because, let's say you have an AV receiver that's a little bit older, and we're not talking a whole lot older, we're talking 1 or 2 years in many cases. And that AV receiver did not support HDCP 2.2 copy protection. If that was the case, then having that second HDMI output was really handy, because you could send the audio to the AV receiver separate from the HDCP 2.2 copy protected video that you could send directly to your television. Now, of course, the Xbox One S only has a single HDMI output. It works with HDCP 2.2. But if you are sending it through your receiver must also support HDCP 2.2, which all of the modern ones do. Almost all of the ones that came out last year do. But there's lots of people who bought an AV receiver 2 or 3 years ago or longer. And it won't have that copy protection. So it's something to be aware of on the audio side that could cause a hiccup because the 4K video won't be able to be sent through an AV receiver that doesn't have HDCP 2.2. Maybe a little bit more disturbing, though. And I said, I am very much into high quality audio. I care about that a lot. The Xbox One and the Xbox One S, neither of them can send Bitstream HD audio out. Some people will say, I see a Bitstream setting in my audio settings of my Xbox One and my Xbox One S. But the only options are for regular Dolby Digital or regular DTS, the legacy lossy codecs. There is no support for Dolby True HD, and therefore no support for Dolby Atmos, because that requires a Dolby True HD bitstream output, and no support for DTS HD Master Audio bitstream output, which means no DTS:X, because just like Atmos requires a DTS HD Master Audio bitstream output. That's the situation there. If you're trying to listen to Atmos or DTS:X, not going to happen. Not right now, anyway.
Not right now. So you're saying there's a chance.
All the more reason for me to wait, right?
Well, I mean, if you don't care about that, then what does it matter? It will decode Dolby True HD 7.1 and send it out as 7.1 PCM. It will decode 7.1 DTS HD Master Audio into 7.1 PCM, send it out that way. Now, there's another fun little fact about the Xbox One, and this is another thing that could be updated, and it's been annoying everyone who's cared about this since day one, and we can't figure out why in 3 years, in all the updates that have come out, they've never managed to fix this. But let's say the disc you're playing, or the content you're playing for that matter, streaming it from Netflix or what have you, is in 5.1 audio, which is pretty darn common. But you have a 7.1 speaker setup. And you said, well, some of the content I watch is 7.1. So of course, I'm going to set my Xbox One or my Xbox One S to send out 7.1 PCM audio. That only makes sense, correct? Except when you're playing 5.1, for some reason, it maps the surround channels to the surround back channels, which is bizarre. Like, it makes no sense. This is a very simple thing that can be fixed in an update. It boggles the mind that it's still going on, but at present, it's still the case. I don't know why. You have to manually go in there, set it to 5.1 PCM to get it to map things correctly, and then set it back to 7.1 PCM when you're playing 7.1 content. Very frustrating.
Has Microsoft acknowledged that problem?
They sure have. In fact, there was an interview with Albert Pinella, who's the senior director of product marketing and planning. And a lot of people pointed to that interview. They said, oh, right in there, he said, yeah, we're aware of these things. There'll be an update. We'll allow for Bitstream audio output. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, it's coming soon. I saw so many headlines saying, Microsoft says Bitstream output is coming to the Xbox One S soon. Well, he went on to the NeoGAF forums and said, I didn't say soon. That's a quote. I didn't say soon. I don't want people to infer soon. It's really a question of when, not if, but I've learned my lesson in trying to predict the future with certainty. That unquote, those are his exact words that he typed. Of course, that's only one representative at Microsoft, but we know that somebody at the company is aware of this stuff. But he went on to say in further posts, it's like, it's on their list somewhere, but they have so many other things that they consider a higher priority. It's a shame that audio, for whatever reason, gets such short shrift. But we understand why they're going with the PCM output. It's because that's the only way to mix in other sounds, right? If you want alerts to give you your little beep while you're watching a Blu-ray or an Ultra HD Blu-ray movie, if you want to be able to mix in audio, like have your, the new feature where you can play audio in the background while a game is playing, right? To do those things, everything has to be decoded into a similar format. In this case, of course, it's going to be PCM. Everything has to be decoded into PCM so it can be mixed within the box, and then either would have to be re-encoded, which is exactly how the Dolby Digital and DTS outputs works. It's being re-encoded after it was all mixed in PCM. So just having the straight right off the disc bitstream output, there's no hardware limitation. It could be done. It's just they can't do all the other things that they sort of want their system to be able to do. They'd have to put in disclaimers or try to educate the public and say, hey, look, if you choose this option, that's great. You'll be able to hear Atmos and DTS:X now, but you won't be able to get an audio alert. You won't be able to play background music anymore. Like all of those types of things, right? So yeah, I can see why they're struggling with it a little bit.
Yeah, that's a tricky situation. But like you said, it's all potentially able to be solved via software update.
Yes. And cool. And giving the user the option, but I think they're a little bit trepidatious about not everyone completely understanding what they're getting themselves into. Why didn't I get... I was waiting for a really, really important alert. I didn't hear it. Why not? I blame you, Microsoft.
Right. Yeah, but both of these could lead to angry complaints. So they just have to pick which angry complaints they want to deal with. So,
yeah, it's like how many people want background music versus how many people are actually using an Atmos setup. And there's probably a lot fewer using an Atmos setup right now.
Right, right. So does that pretty much cover the current situation of HDR with the Xbox?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to HDR specifically, high dynamic range, you have to understand it's HDR 10 only. That is the only signal that is coming out of that Xbox. And as you mentioned, was it last week or the week before, but the pass-through, the HDMI pass-through, that doesn't work. You can't be sending 4K HDR signals through the Xbox One S using that HDMI pass-through function. That isn't going to work right now. So yeah, all that's coming out of there is HDR 10. I guess if you were to go over to the UK and buy a TV that only understands HLG, you're kind of still okay because you can convert between the two thanks to BT2100. So,
okay. All right. So one last question I have for you then. When the Xbox One S was announced and it was announced that it was going to have an Ultra HD Blu-ray player in it, we said, well, this automatically becomes one of the most competitive and maybe the best option for someone looking for an Ultra HD Blu-ray player. Given the fact that it doesn't support Atmos and DTS:X, would it still be your go-to suggestion for someone looking for an Ultra HD Blu-ray player?
If they're not using Atmos or DTS:X, and if they have any interest in expanding beyond just playing discs, right? Because, I mean, of course, if you're talking to someone who all they want to do is play discs, I'm probably not going to tell you to go buy a video game console, even if it's the cheapest option, just because, you know, it comes with a game controller, not a remote, right? The whole interface is going to be overwhelming to someone who just wants to put a disc in and play the darn thing and not have to set up. You know, one of the things that's a little bit annoying is if you get an Xbox One S fresh out of the box, it doesn't have a Blu-ray player app on it. You have to at least go to the store and download the Blu-ray player app. I mean, just that step for someone who just wants to plop in a disc and play the darn thing, that could be a frustration. But yeah, if you have any interest in using a plethora of streaming services, and as a streaming box, it's kind of interesting because even though the Xbox One S is a very powerful machine, when it comes to actually even just Netflix, say, loading up Netflix or Plex, like we've been talking about, or Embee, it doesn't launch it as fast as something like an NVIDIA Shield TV does for whatever reason. It doesn't scroll through all of the cover art quite as quickly and smoothly. It doesn't begin to play the disc when you hit play quite as fast. But all of that, we're talking very first world problems. It's like, oh no, it took 5 seconds instead of three. You know, it's that type of change. So because it's so versatile, if you have any interest and you're not running Atmos or DTS:X yet, and hopefully that update eventually comes. It's still very much recommended, but there has to be that caveat, right? Somebody gets an Atmos system, says, I have an Xbox One S. Yay, I can play Ultra HD Blu-rays.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, you had mentioned a little bit earlier about you're using a lot of Plex lately. And I know that you recently wrote up a rather large tutorial on getting HD audio, which you might need to just briefly explain what the heck HD audio is for some of our listeners, working with Plex on a home theater PC, which frankly sounds downright fitting for our audience. So what have you got going on there?
Yeah, so I mean, all of this came about because one of our listeners from AV Rant just wrote in saying he's actually a fellow who is visually impaired. And he says because of that, you know, he's using screen reader programs. It's not quite as easy for him to just have a broad level explanation. He's like, can you give me a step by step? And it happened to be one night when Tom wasn't available to record on our normal Monday night. I said, I'm going to use this time that I have set aside on Monday night to create a video tutorial for him. So it came out about 25 minutes long, and it's just a slideshow. There's no video or anything to it. It's just a slideshow, but I threw it up there on YouTube. And if you come to avrant.com, you can find the link for that, or it'll be posted in the show notes here for Entertainment 2.0 as well. But yeah, I sort of started at the highest level, which is, let's say you got a home theater PC and you just want to play a Blu-ray disc, because even that isn't quite as simple as one might hope. So I started right there, and it actually comes up later because when it comes to Plex, what we want to use are MKV files. That's what it is able to nicely understand, transcode, send out to all your other Plex client apps that might not be on a PC. Maybe they're on your mobile device, your tablet, or your set-top box, or built right into a smart TV. So everything's coming in MKVs. And so the process of using Make MKV to do your disk backups, but retaining the full quality lossless audio. So when I say HD audio, that's sort of the colloquial term for Dolby True HD, DTS HD Master Audio, and then Dolby Atmos and DTS:X as well. That is the full lossless, these require a bitstream to hear them properly types of things. So I've seen other tutorials out there, but so many of them don't focus on the audio. They're fine with it being just Dolby Digital 5.1 or DTS 5.1 or even stereo for that matter. And I'm like, no, I want the full quality. Sure. I've got Blu-ray discs because I want Atmos, because I want DTS:X. How do I get that out of there? And one of the issues is you use Make MKV, and you know, this is, I explained this in the tutorial, it's too much to go over here, but sometimes you see a whole bunch of titles, you don't know which one is actually the movie. I show you how to figure out which one is the one that you actually want to convert. And then in the past, if you're using something like, let's say, VLC, you could kind of get it to work. But to do it, it was important to select only, say, the DTS HD Master Audio soundtrack and none of the other soundtracks that were on the disc. You know, don't allow it to have the DTS 5.1 core audio in the MKV file, because maybe it'll default to that instead of the one you want. And there's no easy way to switch. Very annoying. More than that, though, you bring it directly into the Plex Media Server and you say, try playing back that MKV file in the web interface, which you can do, of course, right? There's a player right there in the web interface. It doesn't give you bitstream output. It gives you, at best, decoded PCM, and sometimes, depending on the browser you're using, only gives you stereo. So thankfully, Plex has this thing called Plex Media Player, and we have to delineate between that and the Windows Plex app, because you look down there and say, hey, Plex Player for Windows. Nope, not that. Plex Media Player, specifically that name, which right now is in preview, requires a Plex Pass. But I've been very, very impressed with Plex Media Player. It's been well worth paying for the Plex Pass. It's wonderful, because I've been dealing with MKV files for a while. It's been so frustrating having this thing of, maybe I want to keep the director's commentary and be able to switch to it when I want to. Doesn't seem like an insane thing to want to do with a feature movie, but it's been far more difficult than it should have been. This, you just either right click or you hit the A button on your keyboard to switch between audio tracks, and it just switches on the fly. The movie doesn't stop. It just works, and it shows you which one you're playing in a little display right there. And the bitstream output works, and Atmos shows up on the front of your AV receiver, and DTS:X shows up on the front of your AV receiver, as long as you've set it in the settings, which I show you how to do in the tutorial. So I've been very impressed with it. Now, the one sort of little bit of downside to it is a lot of people are using the NVIDIA Shield TV, which we mentioned before can be your Plex server. Now, of course, if you play it within the Plex server, not going to work for this bitstream output. If you use the Plex app, which is the Android TV Plex app, it's been a frustrating thing, because when NVIDIA Shield TV updated to their 3.2 version of their software, one of the things they touted was, you can play Dolby True HD now. You can play DTS HD Master Audio in bitstream format. They splashed it right up there in their marketing. Problem was, the Plex app supported DTS HD Master Audio bitstream output, but not Dolby True HD.
Oh, geez.
So it's like, so close. So very, very close. And sort of the interesting thing to come out of all of that is there actually is Plex Media Player available for the Raspberry Pi, and it works. So if you're willing to spend a little bit of money on a Raspberry Pi, because those aren't expensive, and load Plex Media Player onto the Raspberry Pi, all of a sudden you get all the glorious Dolby Atmos and DTS:X that you could ever want for a very inexpensive little set-top box player. So that's sort of been the solution at the moment, and hopefully everything will get updated to work the way we hope it does.
All right, one last Plex-related question for you. This comes from a listener in the chat, Sola Swede. He says, does Plex support things like SACD ISOs or DSD?
So no ISO files. And that's a little bit of a shame, because if you want to try and play back the full disc, you can't quite do that. So no, not to ISOs. Now, SACD. First of all, I'm as much as I tried to dig into this, not a Plex
DVD
expert.
DVD audio. Come on.
Right. Well, PCM. That's exactly it. PCM, which is what DVD audio was. It was PCM audio. DSD support really isn't there inside of Plex. If you convert it to PCM, it'll play that. and for all the people who are like, TSD sounds better. I'm really sorry. There is absolutely no scientific evidence to back up that claim. but yeah, no, for those formats, not as of yet, no.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that covers most of our Plex and all of this HDR stuff. Let's get into just a little bit of gaming news tonight. Richard, you haven't said much. I'm sure this is where you'll jump into the show, right?
Absolutely. This is my thing.
Yeah, maybe not. So real quick, if you're on the Xbox preview program and you're getting the preview updates, well, good news, because you've got some new features to play with this week. The much earlier announced features of clubs, Xbox clubs, and a feature called Looking for Group, now available to preview users. This is true on the Xbox and on the Windows 10 side. Clubs is exactly what it sounds like. You can make a club about anything. It can be a club of your friends, your coworkers, a club based around drifting in Forza. I mean, anything you want. You make a club, you invite people to it, you can control who's in it. You get your own chat for it, you know, lots of features like that you would expect from clubs. And again, across PC and Xbox. So if you're a World of Warcraft player, might actually be worth looking into this, because apparently banding together and trying to organize stuff in WoW is a nightmare. And this is actually being used by a lot of WoW players to make that easier. Looking for Group, this is a service that a lot of people have like built whole websites around to get this functionality. Now it's built into the Xbox. Basically, what it is you say, what I really want to do right now is I want to play The Division, and I'm looking to do this particular raid or whatever they call that. I don't remember. So I want to do this raid in The Division right now. I want three other people with me. You must have a headset, and you can't be a jerk. And then you just put that out there, and people can search and view those looking for group recommendations and join you. And it's basically just, both of these features are just new ways of finding people like you to play games with and enjoy your gaming time with. So these sound like really cool features. I want to check them out soon. That'll be really, really cool. And then they've also updated the gamer score leaderboards, which are a fun way to compare how you're doing in terms of achievement hunting to the rest of your friends. They've made some just regular performance enhancements and stuff to the leaderboard. They've also changed the time period for which it displays the data. It used to be like a rolling 30-day period. Now it's by calendar month. So the first of the month, the scoreboard resets, and you've got a new chance to try and beat all of your friends at your achievement hunting. So all pretty cool features. My guess would be, you know, these things, of course, they always come to the preview first, but they tend to release from preview fairly quickly. So I would bet that sometime in the second half of September, even, this would probably be rolling out to the rest of the Xbox One user base. Another quick update on the gaming side, Forza Motorsport 6 Apex. Not a game we've talked a lot about, and it may not even sound familiar to a lot of you. This is the Windows 10 version of Forza Motorsport 6.
Okay.
Back in, I want to say April, it went into open beta. You just go to the Windows Store, you download this to your Windows 10 PC. As long as it's a pretty beefy PC, I mean, you're not just going to download this to your random laptop and expect it to work. You've got to have a pretty decent graphics card and some higher end specs for this to even work at all. But it's a free to play game. They've got a limited set of cars and limited tracks, but different challenges and stuff to do. Worth checking out if you're into the Forza type games. Well, it's now officially out of beta, and they've added, finally, support for steering wheels. I'm really excited about this. They've got, we'll have a list, a link to this in the show notes, but they've got a list of all of the wheels they support currently. It's basically all of the ones you would expect from Logitech and Thrustmaster. If you're a Fanatic wheel fan, they don't support them yet, but they're working on it, and they're expecting support for those wheels to come out very, very soon. T- today was also the big announcement from Sony on what they're doing with their consoles. And I had planned to talk about this a little bit more, but we're already running kind of late here, so I won't spend a lot of time on this. But
can I just say I'm disappointed?
I think a lot of people are. So they announced the PlayStation 4 Slim. It's basically exactly what had been leaked and what we'd expected. It's just a smaller, slimmer PlayStation 4. It's $300. And it ships on September 15th. There's no new features in their Slim. They also announced the PlayStation 4 Pro. This is what we thought was going to be called the Neo. It's not. It's called the Pro, which I think is kind of a dumb name for a video game console, but who cares? This is the really interesting part. So it's got a slightly faster CPU. It's got a 1 terabyte hard drive instead of 500 gigs. They say that the GPU is over double the power of the current PlayStation 4, and that it supports 4K gaming. They mentioned 4K gaming a ton. They mentioned HDR a ton. It's HDR10 if you care, which you should care. But kind of the interesting thing here is none of this sounds powerful enough for true 4K gaming. So I went back, I watched the presentation again, and was really trying to key in on what the heck they were saying here. And what they said in terms of 4K gaming was that it renders impressively close to realizing the complete potential of 4K displays.
Mm.
And that's after they said it uses streamlined rendering techniques, including temporal and spatial anti-aliasing. That's all a bunch of technical mumbo jumbo for most people. But what this really means is they're probably rendering higher than 1080p and then upscaling the rest of the way.
I don't maybe even know if they're going above 1080p.
They may not even be going above 1080p. So we'll see. The other interesting thing here is it's coming out soon. It's coming out this year, November 10th, for only $399. The price kind of makes sense considering the specs aren't crazy out there like what we're expecting from the Scorpio. But I was expecting this announcement to kind of clear up some questions about where the heck the video game industry is going in terms of what's a generation. And, you know, because Microsoft has made this kind of weird in that they're saying no more generations. We're just going to release new, better hardware occasionally. And PlayStation, you know, Sony got out here and said PlayStation 4 Pro is not the start of a new generation. It's not a console that's going to blur the lines between generations. I'm not exactly sure about that. Like, they basically were really focused on this is a console for this generation and kind of implying there's going to be a PlayStation 5. There will be another generation from us. And that's not what Microsoft is saying. And that just kind of murkies the waters and where the heck all of this is going. Because if they want to go to the next generation and Xbox One, you know, the Microsoft side is doing something completely different. In a couple of years, the game console space could look pretty different. And I really don't know what to expect out of that.
Why is that a bad thing?
I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
Convinced. Okay, because I don't see why they need to kind of run lockstep with the way they age their hardware, the way they handle their hardware distribution. I would like the different game console manufacturers to think differently, to try to do something innovative and new and not try to keep up with the other guy. I think that in some way is keeping them back, and I'm happy to see them diverge a little bit.
Well, I think maybe the issue is more on the developer side, right? Because the advantage that the consoles had and the advantage that Microsoft and Sony being very close to one another for all intents and purposes over the past three generations is that, you know, it allowed the developers to say, we know what our target is for the hardware. And by the end of the console generation, they were doing remarkable things on hardware that you might not expect. Like, it would take a much more powerful PC to do the same thing because it's less efficient when you are coding for a huge potential hardware base. So the problem that I'm seeing here is if there's a new console coming out every year, and not necessarily a new one from Microsoft every year or a new one from Sony every year, but they're maybe going back and forth or some years both of them bring out a new one, and then, you know, next year one of them goes ahead or whatever. It's this moving target, this constant moving target. Now, obviously, developers have been dealing with that on the PC side forever, but it renders moot this advantage of knowing what the hardware target is going to be for those developers. And, you know, if you have a 3-year development cycle on a game, you're now saying, I literally don't know what the most powerful console is going to be 3 years from now, right? That is a tricky thing for them to have to do. But I think he kind of buried the lead, which is, it's not an Ultra HD Blu-ray player. It's not. Come on, Sony. Come on.
Which is kind of staggering. I mean, come on. These are this is the company that basically won Blu-ray.
Yeah.
They caused Blu-ray to win because they put a player in their console.
Yep.
Pretty much.
I mean, come on.
Yeah. Well, Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, but Sony doesn't offer an Ultra HD Blu-ray player at all currently, do they?
That's right, but at IFA they did show a prototype, which is basically an empty box under glass, but they said end of this fiscal year, which of course could mean as late as April 2017. But they have said they're gonna have an Ultra HD Blu-ray player, and when they said that at IFA, I was like, ooh, or maybe PlayStation 4, at the time Neo. I'm like, now there's a chance. I'm like, because if Sony is saying we're gonna have an Ultra HD Blu-ray standalone player, I was crossing my fingers. So that's why I was disappointed. I'm like, because, you know, hey, they allow bitstream output from the PlayStation 4. They did it. I don't know how they did it.
Well, you know, you could probably still buy that 4K movie server if you wanted to have that in your home, right? Oh, wait, nobody bought that.
Right.
Yeah, not to mention Kaleidoscape, it completely went out of business too. Not sure if you guys talked about that one. But
no, that's not so relevant for this group, but yeah, that was sad.
Yeah. One other announcement from Sony, and that is that all PlayStation 4 consoles, including one that you might have bought way back in 2013, they're all getting a firmware update next week to support HDR10. Now, Rob, I did a little bit of checking on this. From what I can tell, the PlayStation 4 uses HDMI 1.4. Does that Correct. Support HDR10?
Well, yes, because, God, I have to be really careful with that. It's a port, all right? It's a port through which data can be sent. And in the case of the original PlayStation 4, it is a port that can send out 10.2 gigabits per second of data. You can make that data almost anything you want as long as you have the processing power behind it, right? When we're talking about standalone devices, we're talking about system-on-chip design, which means that if you don't have copy protection or support for a resolution or whatever built into that chip, there isn't an easy way to add it. But when you're talking about a central processing unit and a separate GPU, it'll cost you something in terms of that CPU or that GPU might have to do more work, but you can write software for it to add whatever in, and you can send whatever data you want out of an HDMI 1.4 port, if you can program the data to be sent out of it. So that's fine. The only real limitation here is that it's got 10.2 gigabits of gigabits per second of bandwidth to work with instead of the full 18 gigabits per second that actually the new PS4 Slim will have, because it has HDMI 2.0a. So we're saying there were no changes at all. Not quite true. It had that one change. It has an HDMI 2.0a port on it. But 10.2 gigabits per second is fine as long as we're not dealing with, let's see, what would it be? 4K resolution at 60 frames a second with 444 chroma subsampling. All right. If you're not doing that, if you're doing anything less than that, then it's fine.
Okay.
10.2 is sufficient. So yeah, they can do this. If you're saying Sony said they're going to do this, and I don't think they can because of hardware limitation, that is not true. They can do this. You can send out 4K. You can do, as long as you keep it to 420 chroma subsampling, you'll fit within that bandwidth cap. So yeah, but to say HDMI 1.4 can do HDR10, that would be really. Let's get one thing clear. HDMI LLC, the guys behind HDMI, they don't want us to talk about spec numbers. That's an internal thing. It always gets out there, but they're like, the spec number does not tell you what the device can do. It has nothing to do with that. The spec number basically tells you how much bandwidth it has to work with and how many pins in the HDMI connector are physically connected to a wire. Okay. That's what the spec tells you. What you want to do with all of that is up to you.
Right? Okay.
So they want us to talk about capabilities, not spec numbers. And so this will work.
All right, last question. Rob, are you buying either of these PlayStations?
No, not I. And honestly, I think what does make sense about this whole PlayStation 4 Pro is for PlayStation VR, right? They said the key thing, which is that if you buy a PlayStation 4 Pro and you buy PlayStation VR, you can run PlayStation VR at a higher frame rate.
That's really what this seems like it's aimed at.
That is massively important when it comes to VR. It is,
if you don't want to puke.
Utmost important. Yeah.
They spent a whole lot of time talking about 4K, and I really do feel like the main reason this thing exists is to get higher frame rates for PlayStation VR.
It is the 4K streaming services, though, too, right?
Like, sure.
As much as they said you'll have HDR support on your standalone PlayStation 4, you're not going to have 4K support from the streaming service. So Netflix 4K, right? Is Amazon on there? Amazon 4K? I think maybe.
I'm not sure.
Maybe. I don't know. But anyway, 4K streaming services, which Sony is very much into, you know, that's not going to work unless you get one of these new systems. So that part makes sense.
Okay. So that's going to do it for our news tonight. We're going to jump into our entertainment centers. Richard, we're at a long show. Are you going to make this an even longer show by telling us what you've been doing?
It really has been Richard's fault, too. I mean, the guy just wouldn't let me get a word in edgewise.
I know. I just keep on talking. I'm sorry. Talking.
Man, have I dominated this show. I feel bad.
No, that's quite all right. So I broke my media center.
Oh, no.
I don't know what I did. I really don't know what I did, but I broke it somehow. I know I made some minor config change. I don't even remember what it was, but it's broken. I can't fix it. So here's what's going on. Anytime I go to record something, can't find a tuner. Anytime I go to watch TV, can't find a tuner. Go to add tuners, I get an error that I need to restart the services for Media Center. I go to restart the services, and yeah, fine. They restart fine. No problem. Can't add or see or use the tuners. Really unhappy about this. I'm particularly unhappy about this because the other thing that I did this weekend was that I finally installed my over-the-air antenna in the attic this weekend. So I figured, awesome, I'll pull out my old HD Home Run, the original HD Home Run over-the-air tuner with two tuners and add to my capability. Nope, not happening. So I don't know what's going on with that. Now I have to rebuild the thing. This is why I'm recording Big Brother on Plex, because I got to have my Big Brother fixed, right? So hopefully it recorded tonight. Additionally, I've been watching Tyrant. Tonight is the supposed to be season finale, but I understand from our chat room, thank you very much, that it is the finale
series
that
finale.
They did not renew the series, and I don't think this season finale is intended to wrap things up, so that's very disappointing.
Probably not.
Yeah, I had mentioned that I had been watching Stranger Things, and we finished that. Really, really liked that. They've announced that there will be a second season of that, so I'm excited about that. I am finally caught up on last season's Hawaii Five-0. This weekend, we watched the live-action Jungle Book movie, and I'm so proud of myself. I didn't cry, but it was still really good. And something that may make me cry is that this week is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. I probably won't cry, except to know how terrible those first episodes are. And in case you forgot, MeTV is actually showing the original episodes in the order that they were aired starting tomorrow. We're recording on Wednesday, so the 8th of September, that would be Thursday, is in fact the anniversary of the first episode airing for Star Trek 50 years ago. Kind of hard to believe.
Wow.
And as an added bonus, if you're a philatelist like I am, look it up. You can buy sheets and first day covers from the post office commemorating the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
How do you spell philatelist?
I'll let you figure that out.
All right. Okay.
So that's it for me. What have you been watching?
Mr. Robot, I've caught and passed you in Mr. Robot, and I'm so mad about that because I need to be able to talk about Mr. Robot.
I know. I need to catch up. Maybe while I'm on flights this coming few days.
Sure, and then you'll be gone. Catch up on that. And I won't be able to talk to you still. All right. So that's all I've been watching. In terms of gaming, this past weekend was the Battlefield 1 beta. Definitely had to check that out. In fact, I think that's ending this week. So if you didn't get a chance to check it out and you're not listening live, well, you've probably missed your opportunity. I found it to be a pretty fun game. I have not played a Battlefield game since, and this is going to be really screwy considering the names of these two Battlefield games. I haven't played Battlefield since Battlefield 2. And yes, this is Battlefield 1, like 10 years later. It's 1 because World War 1, all this stuff. So it's been like 10 years since I've played a Battlefield game. I really liked it, but it's very, very, very team focused. Because of the early issues they had with the beta, I never really got to play with a bunch of my friends. I only got to play with one. He wasn't really digging it, so it's definitely, unfortunately, ended up on the I'm going to pass on this list for fall games that's coming out, probably in terms of shooters, either just going to be sticking with Overwatch this fall because it's so fun, or there's still a possibility that we'll end up with Call of Duty Infinite Warfare, but don't know, as the beta for that isn't until like late October, so don't know on that. And one other thing. I ordered an Xbox Design Lab controller, and it will surprise no one to know that it's bright yellow. And
of course it is.
I ordered that on the 31st of August. I got ship confirmation earlier this week. I'm supposed to have it by next Monday. I am so excited for this controller.
That is very cool. There needs to be a way to show that live while you're gaming with someone online. You know, they have to be able to see you holding that. Because otherwise, how will people know?
That's true. Yeah, I need it like with my avatar or something. Show
well,
my
yeah, at the very version. At the very least, it's your profile pic, right?
Yeah, I like that idea. Good idea. All right, Rob, anything you've been watching that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, gosh, I sure wish I could have been watching more. There's actually been some sort of family health stuff going on in the background, so I have had exceedingly little time. So when I look at my DVR list, I look for the shows that maybe they're like 2 hours long, but I can watch them in about half an hour because there's so much ads and talking and stuff I don't care about that I can just skip through it. That's the show I go to first. So that has been America's Got Talent for me, which is... maybe call it a summer guilty pleasure, but honestly, this year has been impressive. It's been genuinely impressive talent. So I've actually been quite enjoying the performances going on there. It's these like 15 and 12 year old kids are like just slaying it. They're just killing everybody. So it's really pretty impressive. Speaking of gaming, I did check out WWE 2K16. I know that is perhaps Josh's favorite game of all time. Dude, you are so not missing anything by not playing that game. Amounts to waiting to hit the right trigger. That is the entirety of the game, because all you can do is try to reverse what the computer opponent does to you, which is sheer timing on the right trigger. It's not mashing it. It's not like a mini. It's just you have to nail the timing. You have to count frames and hit the timing just right to reverse it, because they will reverse every move you try to do to the computer. And that is the entirety of the game. So yeah, you really didn't miss much there. It did eat up a lot of time waiting for stuff to load, though.
Well, thank you for sharing that with our listeners. Anybody who did download it, just go ahead and delete that. All right. Well, Rob, you mentioned at the beginning of the show, you've got that SVS giveaway contest over at your AV Rant website. Definitely want to plug that again, because it's not every day you get an opportunity to win awesome, awesome, awesome speakers or subwoofers for your own living
room.
That's
right. And dual subwoofers, folks. And that is hugely important. If you don't know why dual subwoofers are so important, literally check out any previous episode of AV Rant, because at some point we will talk about that. But yeah, but avrant.com, you come to our website, it'll be right at the top of the page. All you have to do is enter your email address. The only cost, quote unquote, to you will be that you'll be signed up for SVS's newsletter. And again, sorry, but only open to residents of the US and Canada. But yeah, we're excited about it. I know so many podcasts do giveaways and stuff like that, and it's like no big deal, but it's kind of, it's the first one we've done. So I'm still super stoked about it. So forgive my excitement. It's a great way to start. You can't beat that.
And then if you win them, then you have to go back and listen to our last episode with Rob so you can learn how to do the crawl.
Yes, the subwoofer crawl. Well, honestly, if you select the two subwoofers, then you don't. Ooh, I'll tease you on that one. If you have the two and you set them up the way we describe on AV Rant, then you don't actually need to do the crawl anymore. It's only when you have one.
Good point. See, just a little nugget of information. And you would get so much more if you listen to AV Rant every single week.
If you have that kind of time, I applaud you.
All right, Richard, you're not going to be here next week. Why?
Yeah, that is correct. I am not going to be here because I am going to be at the CEDIA show. It used to be called the CEDIA Expo. Then they changed the name. Then they changed it back. Now I don't know what to call it. So I just call it CEDIA show. But anyway, this is the Custom Installers show, and there's a whole lot of do-it-yourself and over-the-shelf products that they're showing off there, because we're seeing this convergence of the high-end installer space and the retail space where people can buy and do stuff themselves, and that's really coming out loud and strong at these types of events. So I'm excited to be covering that next week for Home On, and usually there's some really cool TVs and other AV things there too. So I suspect I'll have some interesting news for this show when I get back.
And projectors, if you can. Projectors.
Projectors, yes. I'm not a projector guy, but yes, there are some very cool projectors there usually. So I will be there. And if you are in the Dallas area, either for that or just because you happen to be there and interested in connecting, let me know. I'll be in town for the week.
Very cool.
So this did not come across at all during this podcast because I really have not allowed Richard to speak at all, which is horrible of me, and I apologize for that. I want to say to Richard on air in front of everybody, I am so impressed with your work when it comes to the home automation space. I love Home On. It is way up there in my list of podcasts that I always listen to first as soon as there's a new episode. I love the work that you're doing. I am hugely impressed. I'm a huge fan of yours. So that really did not come across in this showing. I regret that tremendously. But at least I got to say it that much. It might sound disingenuous based on how I've performed tonight, but there we go.
Not at all. Thank you very much, Rob. That means quite a lot coming from you. I really appreciate it.
Very welcome.
All right. Well, to get us out of here, we always like to share our contact information with you. Richard and I can be found on Twitter. He's at Richard Gunther. I'm at Josh Pollard. The website is at DigiMediaZone. And Rob, I know you're on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
I sure am. I am at First Reflect. So yeah, you can reach me that way on Twitter. And I don't post a whole ton over there, but it's certainly a way to reach out to me.
Cool. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/TheDMZ. We're on Google+, where there's a Windows Media Center community that is still fairly active. Check that out if you're a Media Center user still. Our email address is entertainment@thedigitalmediazone.com. If it's too long, just use the contact form on the website. As Rob just alluded to, Richard's got that other podcast, Home On, covering home automation news. Richard, what's going on with Home On?
Our next episode coming out is with PR rep Ashley Dano from Castor Communications. And she and I had a great conversation about what's going on with Sonos, what's going on in the Echo space, and we talk a little bit about what we might end up seeing at CEDIA. So it was a great episode, and you should see that in your feeds very soon.
Cool. Well, if you like any of our shows, you can find all of them pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts: iTunes, Pocket Cast, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, Google Play. If you like them, subscribe. You know, that's the first thing. Go and subscribe to the show so you don't miss out on any of them. And then if you really like them, head on over to iTunes, give us a rating, give us a review. It helps us out a ton. Doesn't cost you much time or effort, and we really, really appreciate it. And then If you want to chat with us in real time while we're doing the show, you can do that typically Tuesday nights, 8:30 p.m. Eastern, right at our website at the DMZ. But if you really want to know for sure when it's going to be, because sometimes dates and times move around, follow us on Twitter. We always tweet when we're going to be doing the show live. One last time before we get the heck out of here, Rob, thank you so much for being on the show again. Thank you for sharing all of this wealth of information on HDR and 4K and all of this HD audio and all this other stuff that we have to try and figure out. We're all smarter because of you.
Well, thank you so much. It's absolutely my pleasure. It's always so much fun to come on and join you on this podcast. I'm so happy to get to speak to Richard this time. Like I said, a huge fan of yours. So yeah, absolutely love it, guys. And thanks so much for having me.
Cool. All right. Well, that is going to do it for episode 381. I'm Josh Pollard. He's Richard Gunther. And well, I'll be back next week. Neither of these other two guys will be for episode 382. Until then, adios.
Goodbye.